From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Harvard Law School's Alan Dershowitz has been named to the president's defense team. We'll talk with him about his strategy and his views on presidential power.
Of course the president's not the king. The president's far more powerful than the king.
Today is Friday, so it's time for Week in Review. From impeachment to a dramatic car chase in Springfield.
It's him. This is a blue Honda Civic, and they're doing 100 miles an hour right now.
We'll take your calls on that and your questions for former Massachusetts governor and Republican presidential candidate Bill Weld.
I think they're better than 1 in 50. If I move as much on Mr. Trump as I did in September for the next 2 months, I'm ahead in New Hampshire.
It's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The big story of the day, maybe our lifetimes, is the impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump. The trial officially started in the Senate yesterday, where Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts administered an oath to all 100 senators who will now serve as the jury. Joining us now on the line is someone who is on President Trump's defense team for the trial, attorney and Harvard Law Professor Emeritus Alan Dershowitz. He's also the author of Guilt by Accusation, The Challenge of Proving Innocence in the Age of Me Too. Alan Dershowitz, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Well, thanks. But let me clarify my role in the case. I'm the special constitutional advocate against impeachment on the articles of impeachment that have been forwarded to the Senate. I'm not really a full-fledged member of the defense team. I won't be strategizing with them about witnesses or about facts. My role is limited to presenting the constitutional argument against impeachment, an argument I've made in two books and probably 25 articles.
Will you be present with the Senate and making live arguments during the trial?
Yes. So the plan is for me to present the constitutional argument on a Friday after the White House counsel and the president's private lawyer, Jay Sekulow, speak. The plan is for me to speak after that and present the broad constitutional argument, the history of the impeachment clause, the reason why the framers did not include abuse of power as a criteria for impeachment, that kind of thing.
So I want to come back to that abuse of power question in a minute, but I have a couple other things I'd like to talk to you about first.
Sure.
Have you been coordinating with, in contact with Ken Starr, Jay Sekulow, the rest of the team, and for how long?
I just found out about Ken Starr literally last night. So I had no coordination with him. I've spoken to Jay about my role. Basically, I issued a statement, or a statement was issued describing my role, and that I negotiated with Jay Sekulow because I wanted to play a specific and limited role.
You were very critical of Ken Starr in your book, Sexual McCarthyism.
Yes.
After.
Yes.
Does that complicate your role on this legal team? Because you were concerned, it seems from the book, that maybe his approach to the Clinton impeachment had undermined the Constitution.
I think it did. And we fundamentally disagree about that. In fact, just the day before I learned that he was on the team, I debated him in Dallas, Texas, about just constitutional construction. But, lawyers disagree about things and then they work together. I don't plan to be working in any way together with other members of the legal team. I'm going to be creating and, writing my constitutional arguments and presenting them to the Senate, and then I go home.
So let's talk about
questions also. Yeah.
Let's talk about the Senate trial, the Constitution, the process of the Senate trial, et cetera. And I'll begin by asking you a more generic question. In your mind, what does the Constitution require of the U.S. Senate in an impeachment trial?
Well, the oath says it all. I mean, the ideal of impeachment and removal was set out by Hamilton in the Federalist Papers. And he wanted a nonpartisan process under which there has to be kind of overwhelming support from both all parties and from the people of America. Nixon was the perfect example of that, but it's been the only example of that in our history. Unfortunately, impeachment and removal have become very partisan. And I think the House impeachment was very partisan. And now the shoe is on the other foot. And I wish if I could rewrite all this and rewrite history, I'd much prefer to see an impeachment and removal process that wasn't influenced by which party controlled the House or which party controlled the Senate.
Are there particular Senate rules that you believe need to be in place for this to be a fair Senate trial?
Well, there are rules that are in place, and they're essentially the rules that were in place for the Clinton impeachment, and I'm sure they will be followed. The Chief Justice has some role, but it's probably a very limited role in ruling on contested issues, but probably most of the contested issues will be decided by the Senate.
In the compare and contrast between this trial and the Clinton trial, obviously one of the things that has come up is the question of witnesses. And I recognize that the witnesses were not taken at the beginning of the Clinton trial, but there had been a full body of witnesses in the House. Given that compare and contrast, what do you believe are appropriate obligations of the Senate in this case for hearing from witnesses and taking in any new evidence that may have emerged?
So that's not my role in this case. I'm not going to be involved in the details of the rules of the Senate or what the Senate should do. I'll just give you my personal view, and that is in the Clinton case, they took a long time to interview witnesses. And in this case, it seems to me they pretty much rushed the impeachment. They could easily have, for example, gone to court and sought an immediate ruling on whether or not John Bolton should be required to testify. The president would have invoked executive privilege. The case could have gone to the court very quickly.
But the court might not have decided quickly. I've heard estimates that it could have been into next summer or the fall before we would have had resolution of that set of questions.
Well, no, and it could have taken 2 weeks as well. I mean, I've seen cases like this decided in 2 weeks, particularly when they involved the president. If you had a district court ruling that there was executive privilege, that would have been the end of it. Of course, the House could have appealed that. Or if it went the other way, it would depend on whether a stay was granted. But, you know, the House rushed to impeachment, and then they delayed delivering for a month. So, you know, I think there's a lot of fault to go around here, and finger-pointing doesn't really help solve the problem. It's going to be somebody else's job to decide whether or not the president's team will object to or not object to witnesses. One thing that's clear is if the Democrats can call witnesses, so too can the president's team.
So you talked we talked about the oath that the senators took yesterday. In part, it said to do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws. So help me God. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has been very clear that he is operating in lockstep with President Trump and the White House. Is he capable of being impartial, and is that appropriate given the oath he just took?
Well, he's doing exactly the same thing that the Senate leadership did during the Clinton case.
Is it appropriate?
Well, if I were writing the rules today, I would try to create a situation where nobody should be able to coordinate, where nothing partisan would be done. Hamilton said the greatest fear, the greatest danger is that impeachment and removal will turn on the number of votes you can get in either house and not on the guilt or innocence. So if I were writing the rules, I'd write them that way so that there could be no partisanship, but the rules of engagement were created by the House, and now the Senate's being asked to play by different rules. But when President Clinton was impeached, I was part of that. I testified for Clinton, and then I consulted with his legal team. The leadership of the Senate coordinated very closely with the White House in that case as well.
So we're talking with Alan Dershowitz, who will be on the legal team for President Trump's impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. We've talked about the behavior and choices of the House and the Senate. Let's talk about the behavior and choices of the president and the White House in this process. Do you believe that the president's choices and the White House's approach to subpoenas, et cetera, have been constitutionally sound and appropriate?
Yes, I do. I think that the president, under separation of powers and checks and balances, has the right to invoke executive privilege whenever a partisan vote of the House of Representatives subpoenas a witness who is potentially subject to privilege. Remember, the privilege doesn't belong to the person like Bolton. It belongs to the president as head of the executive branch. and simply demanding that there be judicial orders in the case is not an obstruction of Congress, in my view.
So explain, every legal scholar that we've spoken with so far on this show has suggested that there is a difference between claiming executive privilege, which might mean not answering specific questions when appearing before, say, the House or the Senate, and refusing in any way to participate in the process or even appear. It is hard to imagine as a citizen that that is not essentially a negation of the checks and balances of power and the right of Congress to call the president to account. Maybe there are individual questions not to be answered, but to not show and say, I just won't play in this sandbox, doesn't that seem extreme?
Well, to take, for example, Bolton, his conversations with the president are probably all covered by executive privilege. So a blanket invocation of that privilege seems to me to be appropriate. As a criminal defense lawyer, I will always try to have a blanket refusal of my clients to testify. I might lose in the end, and the courts might say, no, you have to come, and you have to answer some questions and not others. But most defense lawyers will say, no, this is all covered by the lawyer-client privilege, or this is covered by other privileges, and it's or the Fifth Amendment, and it's wrong to call my client and make him invoke privileges one at a time. That's for the courts to decide.
I think the thing that I'm struggling with is the difference, again, between saying I recognize the legitimacy of this process, I will participate in the parts that I can, but I'm claiming executive privilege on these questions because they're protected, versus I do not acknowledge the legitimacy of this process and will not participate in it in any way. Doesn't that risk doing constitutional damage when the president of the United States is one of the protectors of the Constitution?
It's a political decision to make. If the president honestly thinks the process is illegitimate, he's entitled to take that political position. I've had clients who've done the same thing. They've said that they think the indictment was illegitimate, and they're not going to cooperate. Under our system of justice, the burden is always on the accusers. In any event, it doesn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. It could be a political dispute, and people could decide to vote against a presidential candidate because he took that position. But I've never seen anything in the constitutional history that would suggest that broadly invoking executive privilege, even if erroneously invoking it, should be grounds for impeachment. And the Supreme Court has agreed to hear two cases now on this very issue. So when the Supreme Court says these are arguable issues and these are issues that we will have to consider, it's hard to turn them into impeachable offenses.
So would you like to give us a sneak preview, or would you please give us a sneak preview of the arguments you intend to make when you appear before the Senate?
Well, I think I already have. I'm going to look to the words of the Constitution, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. I'll go into the history of how those terms appeared in the Constitution. Originally, the criteria for impeachment included maladministration, malpractice, and other vague open-ended terms. Madison opposed them, saying that open-ended terms could turn our republic into a parliamentary democracy where the president serves at the will of Congress. And the framers of the Constitution didn't want that. And so they restricted it to these four criteria. And I don't think these criteria are met by the two articles of impeachment. That's a brief summary of what I have argued now for 2 years. I would make the same argument if Hillary Clinton had been elected, who I voted for, and she were being impeached. In fact, when I originally wrote my book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump, the original title was The Case Against Impeaching Hillary Clinton, because I thought she'd get elected, and I'd be making exactly the same arguments. I am making a nonpartisan argument against impeachment based on open-ended vague criteria.
It is also a remarkable argument. Your view of presidential power is quite extensive. Here's some comments you made to Fox News' Laura Ingraham last November.
Of course, right. The president's not the king. The president's far more powerful than the king. The president has the power that kings have never had. He's very, very powerful office, and the framers wanted it that way.
I've also heard you make arguments on air that essentially the framers didn't consider abuse of power in high crimes and misdemeanors. But if the president is more powerful than a king, that's a new argument for me to hear, then would one not want to, especially as a civil libertarian like you, account for the possibility that somebody with that much power might abuse it and might need constitutional means to rein that in?
Sure, I agree completely. And let me explain what I meant by more powerful than the king. There was no king that's ever, ever in history been as powerful as the president of the United States. The president of the United States has the power to, you know, and declare a war with nuclear weapons. So the analogy between the president and the king has always been one that I've dismissed. Presidents are more powerful than kings have ever been. And of course, there must be constraints. Let me give you an example, which I will use from the Constitution. Madison, when he argued in favor of having impeachment at all, remember that was an initial debate, should there be impeachment for president? There were many of the framers who said no. He said, no, there has to be impeachment of a president. What if a president becomes incapacitated? What if he just can't govern? And that was a good reason for having impeachment. But when the framers got to the criteria, they did not include that. They did not include incapacity. And so we had to amend the Constitution to include incapacity. We now have an amendment to the Constitution that provides that. The same thing is true about abuse of power. Fully half of our presidents throughout history have been accused of abuse of power by their political opponents. Adams for the Alien Sedition Act, Jefferson for putting Burr on trial, Lincoln for suspending the writ of habeas corpus, go on and on and on and on. The framers quite deliberately left out abuse of power. That was a good reason for having an impeachment, but it was not a criteria because it was too vague and open-ended. And I will argue that, and I think I will argue it compellingly from the history.
But Alexander Hamilton, in Federalist Paper number 65, says the subjects of its jurisdiction are those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public
right.
men, or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. So how could
That's
one
right.
not conceive of a set of circumstances where the President of the United States abused power in such a way that Congress should need to and could be constitutionally within its bounds to remove that president from power?
So here's what Hamilton said. Of course, I'm very familiar with all of Hamilton's writings, but particularly on impeachment. After describing what the criteria are, treason, bribery, other highest crimes and misdemeanors, these are crimes that flow from the abuse of power. But abuse of power in and of itself is not a criteria. The criteria are treason, which is an abuse of power, bribery, which is an abuse of power, high crimes, which are abuses of power. And by the way, there's a distinction between high crimes and low crimes. Clinton was wrongly impeached because he was guilty of a low crime, not a high crime.
But
Hamilton
my understanding is that high actually refers to the office holder, the special power and unique standing
okay.
of the office
true,
holder.
If that were true, then Hamilton should have been impeached. Let me tell you what Hamilton did. When he was Secretary of the Treasury, he had an adulterous affair, which was a felony at the time, a serious felony. Then he paid hush money to make sure that the adulterous relationship was not disclosed. Then he was accused, falsely it turns out, of using Treasury funds for payment of the hush money. He held a high office.
So
but no, he wasn't impeachable because his crime was not a high crime because it did not involve trust in government. Had he paid money from Treasury, it would have been a high crime, and he probably would have been impeached.
So let's talk about this trust in government. That's a helpful phrase for me in understanding your arguments. If Congress appropriated nearly $400 million for Ukraine, if the president holds back money that has been allocated by the Congress for personal gain, does that not undermine trust in government and faithful execution of the government?
Well, let's look at the GAO report. The GAO report said that the president does not have the authority to substitute his preferences over those of Congress. GAO is just totally wrong. They got it completely backwards. It's Congress that can't substitute its authority for the president when it comes to foreign relations. Let's give you an example. Let's assume Congress allocated $400 million to Cuba. The president says, no, Cuba is an enemy under my foreign policy. Elect a different president if you want to give money
But that's
to Cuba,
not about personal gain.
No. But I'm starting out by talking about whether or not GAO didn't talk about personal gain. Let's be clear about that. The GAO only talked about how we violated the law by refusing to send the money to the Ukraine for a period of time.
No, I understand
and
that, but I'm asking you about
They're
personal
wrong
gain.
About that. Well, then you have to impeach him for that, and you have to make it a crime or find an impeachable offense. Would that be bribery? Would it be something else, obstruction of something? But to just claim personal claim when he disputes it, that's an issue that has to be the Congress did not come up with compelling evidence of that to my view. But I'm not getting involved in the factual aspects. That's for other lawyers.
So
I'm
going to
simply argue that when you impeach a president on two grounds, one, obstruction of Congress, which is a made-up concept. It doesn't exist in the law. And the other, abuse of power, and there's no such thing in the law is abuse of power either. It's just a political concept. Those do not rise
but
to
impeachment
the level
does allow offenses. For non so that okay so this is my last question on this and I want to go to one other thing.
Sure.
Are you then essentially arguing that unless it's a violation of something that's essentially in the criminal code that is written in law as a crime that the president can't be impeached?
That's not my position. My position is that to be impeached it has to be treason or bribery or other high crimes. Now other crimes are a reference back to treason and bribery, so in my view it has to be criminal-like conduct akin to bribery and treason. And vague concepts like obstruction of Congress or abuse of power don't fit that description. What you need is, for example, if he commits murder, that would be of a kind comparable to bribery or treason. But the kinds of allegations that are made here are not of a kind with treason and bribery. So I don't think they're impeachable offenses. But no, you don't need a specific violation of an existing criminal statute at the time the Constitution was enacted. That would be too narrow. But that tells us of the type of conduct that the framers had in mind.
Okay, before I let you go, I want to ask you quickly about another legal matter you're involved in. The top law enforcement officer in the Virgin Islands, U.S. Virgin Islands, has brought a lawsuit against the estate of your former client, Jeffrey Epstein, over alleged sexual trafficking and abuse. The details of the alleged abuse are really disturbing. I know
they are disgusting. They're horrible. Yeah.
The New Yorker reported that of all the cases you've taken in your career, this is the one that you regret taking. As more evidence comes forward or more accusations, how are you thinking about your involvement with Epstein now?
Well, I wish I had never met him. I was introduced to him by the Lady Rothschild, Evelyn Rothschild, Rothschild's wife. She told me he was a wonderful man. He was friends with the president of Harvard. My relationships with him were purely academic in the beginning. And then when he was indicted, I was his lawyer. He paid me for every hour that he spent with me. And once he was convicted, my relationship with him terminated. I did what any lawyer would do. Ken Starr was part of that legal defense team, Roy Black, Marty Weinberg, some of the most eminent lawyers in the country were part of his defense team. I think all of us wish we had never laid eyes on him, and you know, because he's hurt so many people, but that's the job of a criminal defense lawyer. It was my job when I defended O.J. Simpson. It was my job when I defended Klaus von Bülow and many other people. And people love me when I defend people they like and hate me when I defend people they hate. But John Adams defended the people who were accused of the Boston Massacre, and Abraham Lincoln defended many guilty people. Those are the models we look to as defense attorneys, and so I will continue to defend people that my wife doesn't like, my mother didn't like, and my friends don't like. If you don't want to do that, don't be a defense lawyer.
And one of Epstein's alleged victims has accused you of abusing her on multiple occasions. You've said you have documentation that proves your innocence.
Do.
Do you expect
I
the
do.
Matter to end up in a trial where you can provide that documentation?
Yes.
And if not, would you do it in some other way?
No, I'm doing it. First of all, I did it in my book, Guilt by Accusation. I have all the documents. I have emails from her acknowledging she never met me. I have a manuscript from her acknowledging she never met me. I have her own lawyer admitting on tape that it was impossible for me to have been in the place that she claims to have met me, and that she is wrong, simply wrong. I have a report by the former director of the FBI who went through every one of my travel documents proving I couldn't have been in the places where she said she met me. So I have been completely exculpated and vindicated in every possible way, except that people don't believe it. Also, I have evidence that this is a woman who falsely accused Al Gore, Tipper Gore, Bill Clinton, claimed she was 14 when she met Epstein. Turns out she was 17.
I'm so sorry. I know there's more you have to say here, but I'm got to move us on to our next segment.
Sure.
That's attorney Alan Dershowitz, Harvard Law professor and a part of President Trump's impeachment defense team. Thanks for giving the time to Radio Boston today.
Thank you. And thank you for giving me an opportunity to respond to your points.
So listening into that conversation was WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, hello.
Hello.
And as we begin, I do want to note you have known Alan Dershowitz for a long time. You guys were colleagues at Harvard for years. And recently you have been a very sharp critic of his support of President Trump. I just want to put that on the table before we ask for your analysis.
Right.
So in July, let me just ask you right off the bat, react to what you heard from Alan Dershowitz.
Well, I think that it's very interesting that Professor Dershowitz is trying to limit his role at this point to simply articulating what the constitutional provisions are, when for the past 3 years, every single position that he has taken in print or on air has been a position consistent with that of the president's. Every factual position, every legal position, every political position. So that's just by way of saying that that's how he indeed positioned himself for the job that he has now. I also could not disagree more with the notion that abuse of power that is really here the functional equivalent of treason, abuse of power, the net effect of which was to undermine American security, national security, by withholding aid from Ukraine, abuse of power that whose net effect was to undermine the electoral process, that is precisely what impeachment was for. He recognizes that impeachment is more than a crime. Then it's hard to imagine how these facts, if proved, would not amount to an impeachable offense, because there is quite simply no other way to address it.
So you're taking issue with his constitutional interpretation, essentially.
Absolutely. In this case, the constitutional interpretation. In other situations, I've taken issue with his facts. Here, I certainly take issue with his constitutional interpretation.
And Judge Gertner, why is it so concerning to you that, and I will paraphrase your argument, that he's been so in lockstep with President Trump and President Trump's legal arguments over the last few years?
Well, I think a part of the reason is this. He's a very learned man. He's a really superb arguer. He can shift from one historical example to another, drop the names of the people that he has interacted with, talk about his experience. And to do this under the guise of appearing as a neutral constitutional scholar when nothing about the past 3 years equips him for that,
I think
is troubling.
What do you make, then, of his argument that if Hillary Clinton were the one who were being impeached right now, he would defend her as well, because this is a set of constitutional questions and not about the person in the office?
Well, I mean, he may well be defending Hillary Clinton, but not necessarily because of the constitutional principles, but because he loves the attention.
All right. WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner, a retired federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. I appreciate you listening in and then providing us your quick analysis afterward.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. So it is Friday, which means Week in Review, which is foreshortened this week because we had the breaking news interview that we did at the top of the hour. But I do want to turn to our Week in Review panelists now for their thoughts. With us in Studio 3 is Seti Warren, executive director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School, former mayor of Newton, Massachusetts. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great Seti. To be with you.
Also with us is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Good to see you, Tom.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, so Tom, let me just start with you. What are your reactions?
So I actually think that Nancy Gertner has the better of the arguments there. So not all abuse of power would be impeachable. I think Dershowitz is completely correct on that. But I think certain abuses of power rise to be similar to treason and bribery. And he's right, other high crimes. In other words, other crimes that are like treason and bribery. And the facts and circumstances that have been outlined in terms of the House's impeachment smell an awful lot like bribing, right? You're using funds to bribe another country in order to do what you want. In treason, there's an argument that's similar to sort of not putting the interests of the United States first, but rather putting your own personal interests first. So I respect what Alan Dershowitz is saying. I actually think that when you think about the argument, it really is what the House has outlined there is obstruction of or is rather abuse of power that rises to be similar to treason and bribery.
Seti Warren, your reactions?
Yeah, I was thinking back that during my time in Washington when I worked for the Clinton administration. I was actually in Washington during the impeachment hearings, and I'm thinking about where we've been and where we're coming from since that point. A couple of points during that time. One, there were Democratic members of the House and Senate that were very angry at President Clinton. They felt that they had been lied to. And in fact, I remember there were events where out and around the country, they didn't want to stand on stage with him. The results happened. We all know what happened. Very different time than where we are now, where it's very clear that both sides are entrenched. It seems as though they've already made up their minds, the senators, most of them. So we have people amplifying their own messages on either side. There's no question that the House did the right thing by proceeding the road of impeachment. The things that President Trump has done do rise to, as Judge Gertner said, high crimes and misdemeanors, abuse of power. What my concern is what happens after this trial. If we all are sitting here assuming, Tom and I were talking, we know what the outcome is. What does that mean for political norms in the United States moving forward? What does that mean for the capacity of the country to actually come together in some way? And since that time, public perception of government has gone down. That time I was in Washington.
Yeah.
So what direction are we really heading in coming out of
yeah.
this?
Go ahead, Tom.
And, you know, I guess I'd add where I really think that Alan Dershowitz had it right is that impeachment is supposed to be a nonpartisan process. And let's face it, ever since Donald Trump was sworn in, there have been a large number of folks who've been trying to impeach him on one ground or another. And now we finally have something. But it does smell as if it has been a kind of a partisan witch hunt all along, just looking for some way to do it. Even though this particular circumstance, I would completely agree, does rise to impeachment, it smells so partisan that people have essentially hardened their positions even before this incident came up.
I'm going to shift gears for us in just a minute. But before we do, one more question I wanted to ask you. The argument that Dershowitz is making about the level of presidential power and the extent to which you can't abuse it according to the Constitution. That's not exclusively what he said, but it's part of the implication of what he said. Should that take hold as mainstream thought on what the Constitution says about the power of the presidency? What do you think are the implications for that, for the balance of power across the three branches, Seti?
Well, you know, I'm an Iraq War veteran, and I spent a year on the ground there in that time. I knew what was happening. I was part of the intelligence community. One thing we've seen in the last 3 weeks is the president coming up with a rationale for making that strike.
Post facto is what you're saying?
Correct. And I think we need to have that discussion. One of the things we have the War Powers Act. I mean, there's one of the reasons why that's in place. So I'm not quite sure I agree with Professor Dershowitz's analysis on that. You know, we have a real life scenario at this moment. Should we be going to war with another country based on a piece of legislation that was passed back in 2002 that authorized the war in Afghanistan, very specifically going after al-Qaeda. This is a real conversation. The Congress has been trying to have it. The Senate's been trying to have it. Now we've seen the president actually act. And I think we need to dig into that in a real way and have that conversation. I think it's a dangerous precedent to say you start calling the president a king, right? This is a real live example of that.
So, Tom, let me invite you to add what you'd like to that.
Yeah, so, I mean, in sort of responding to your original question, if the notion that abuse of power was acceptable or at least non-impeachable took hold, would that be a bad thing? I think the answer is yes. I do think that when you parse the Constitution, this notion of bribery, treason, and other high crimes is referring to circumstances where the abuse is damaging to the nation. There are low levels of abuse all the time. And there are also arguable cases where one's going to claim it's abuse and it's not. But at a thing like treason or bribery or similar circumstances, I do think that that needs to be an impeachable offense.
Okay, I do want to turn to one other story. I want to get local, very local, for just a couple of minutes, and I'm going to give us a little bit of sound. On Wednesday, a harrowing kidnapping happened in Springfield. The suspect wound up in custody, but in the meantime, there was a high-speed chase. And here's Benny Correa and Amanda Disley, the husband and wife who actually chased the kidnapper's car. They were speaking with Western Mass News.
I saw his complete face, and I saw someone in the backseat pushing someone down. And that's when we were like,
It's him. No, this is a blue Honda Civic. And they're doing 100 miles an hour right now.
The kidnapped girl, 11-year-old Charlotte Moshe, was physically unharmed and is now safe. Here's Springfield Police Commissioner Cheryl Claprood speaking to reporters.
This was an absolute life and death situation for this little girl. Thank you to the public for helping us out, and it has come to a very good conclusion.
And it did come to a good conclusion in terms of Charlotte Mosha's safety, although I'm sure she'll carry the burden of that for the rest of her life. What's your reaction to the story, Tom?
Well, you know, I think the reaction of any parent is, this is your nightmare, right?
Yeah.
I mean, your child's just walking home from school, randomly chosen, apparently, and, you know, this is the kind of thing, how can I possibly protect against this? And, you know, part of you says, well, then I'll just hover over my child entirely, which you can't do because you have to let them become independent. And yet these are the risks of independence. It scares the bejesus out of everybody.
Seti, one of the things that's fascinating about this story, now that we know she's safe, is the juxtaposition of the crime with these strangers just showing up for this little girl. I mean, a high-speed chase. They had their kids in the car. They damaged their own pickup truck. They wouldn't let this guy go. That's hopeful. Somehow.
I think it is. You know, I have an 11-year-old daughter, and the first thing I thought about is, where is she right now?
Same age.
And so Tom makes a really good point. But, you know, the fact that this that these people decided that they were not only going to identify the car and send it in, but they were actually going to track that car down is pretty remarkable. And it is hopeful. I hope it inspires people to be more clued in. I mean, I got the Amber Alert and I saw it. I'm in Newton. The next time that these things come across people's screens, maybe it will make them think a little bit more to see something and say something and not just look at it and say, oh, this is too bad, it's sad, but bring a different heightened awareness. I think it may be a good thing in that way.
Yeah, the whole thing plays out like a TV movie. It really is quite remarkable when you look at the circumstances. There's one other piece I want to add to this, though, and that is, and I just saw this in the paper, someone called the guy who did it a monster. And what he did was monstrous. There is a mental health issue allegedly at play here. Allegedly has schizophrenia
and was
off
his
medications. And I think it's really this also calls for us to be aware, ever more aware, about mental health and how much we need to support it.
Okay, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Thanks for joining us. And Seti Warren, Executive Director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead. After the break, we will take your calls with presidential candidate and former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld. I'm Tiziana Deering. Stay with us. There's more Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Over time, we have been trying to bring you conversations with presidential candidates when they're in the region, especially if they're from the region. And joining us now from Concord, New Hampshire, is Bill Weld, Republican presidential candidate and former Massachusetts governor. Governor Weld, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. Pleasure to be with you.
And you, call us, call the governor. We've got him on the line. He's a candidate for the presidency. What do you want to know? What questions do you have for Bill Weld? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Governor, it strikes me that doing well in New Hampshire, which is a state where you have some, you know, real recognition, would be key to any path that you have to the Republican nomination. How important is winning New Hampshire to you, and how are you doing there?
No, it's great in New Hampshire. I'm all over the country, of course. I spent 5 days with my wife in Iowa last week, and we're off to California for 3 days next week. But New Hampshire's been number one destination ever since I announced back in April. I'd say we've been here 3 or 4 days, most weeks since then. And it's a very hospitable environment for me. When I tell people here I'm a New England Republican, they know exactly what I mean. It means I'm flinty, you know, stingy with the budget, but welcoming and tolerant, open on social issues. And that's a good combination in this part of the world. So the strategy, as you say, is to do well beyond expectations, ideally to win in New Hampshire, which might even be a knockout blow for Mr. Trump. But even beyond expectations, I've seen the impact that can have. For example, when Pat Buchanan in 1992 got just 37% of the vote against Mr. Bush 43, who was riding very high, 91%, both parties in the polls. It knocked him right off his pins.
So let's talk about that, because President Trump is consistently polling near 90% among likely Republican voters. A BUR poll from December had just 9% of likely Republican primary voters in New Hampshire saying they'll support you. What is your strategy for bringing those numbers up specifically, especially with the primary less than a month away?
Well, you know, it does bounce back and forth. In the month of September, there was a poll where I went up 11 points and Mr. Trump went down 17 for a net change of 28 points. So it's somewhat volatile. But there is a strategy, which is to make sure that not just members of the Republican State Committee and their, you know, family members and hangers-on vote in the Republican primary. And this is a crossover state like Massachusetts, like Vermont, where independent voters can take any ballot that they want. And that was the secret to my getting elected in Massachusetts. I'd get about 50% of the Republican vote, and then the independents would come in and vote 6-1 for me because I was sort of thought to be a centrist kind of guy. So, you know, I'm trying to get more women to vote in this primary, more younger voters, and broaden the electorate, kind of the opposite of what the Republicans in Washington like to do, which is voter suppression. And that'll be the key to getting my numbers up in New Hampshire, which, as you say, is a big part of the strategy.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your question to Governor Bill Weld. We've got Emmanuel on the line from the Back Bay. Emmanuel, go ahead. What's your question for Bill Weld?
Yeah, hi, Governor Weld. Basically, you've been a lifelong Republican, and I'm just interested in to think, what do you think of what's happened to your party? It's been hijacked. It's been a hostile takeover by a charlatan and a con man. What's going on?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that's true of Republicans as a whole. I'm a little disappointed with the Republicans in Washington who are sitting quietly by and, you know, pretending they're whistling past the graveyard, pretending nothing's going on with the impeachment and possible removal of the president. They're saying, oh, there's nothing there. There's nothing there. That's poppycock. I mean, there's plenty there. But, you know, the rank and file Republicans, I can understand why people were attracted to the energy and freshness of Mr. Trump. I just don't happen to agree with a lot of the stuff he's done in office. I think we can't continue with these trillion-dollar deficits, and we can't insult our allies, and we shouldn't be isolationists, and we shouldn't do tariffs, and we should worry about environmental issues. So obviously there's a lot of things I'd like to do differently, but I don't blame the rank and file of the party for electing Mr. Trump.
Governor, I want to ask you about that, because the Massachusetts Republican Party actually tried to keep you off the Republican primary ballot here until Democratic Secretary of State Bill Galvin stepped in. In Wisconsin, a state Republican committee has kept you off the ballot. So what do you make that? Those are rank and file Republicans. What do you make of their attempt
to keep you off the ballot? Those are not rank and file Republicans.
So talk some more about that.
Those are the Republican state committees. Jim Lyons is the chair of the Republican state committee. Andrew Hitt is the chairman of the Wisconsin State Committee, Republican Party, and the Trump campaign has merged its operations with the Republican state committees in every state. In every state, the Republican state committee is the Trump organization. So that's exactly the tree that it would be no point in my trying to bark up that tree. Jim Lyons called me Benedict Arnold and said I wasn't fit to be on the ballot. But, you know, if you're generally recognized as a serious presidential candidate, other people can put you on the ballot. That's what happened in Massachusetts.
Does it concern you about your ability to penetrate into the Republican vote if, as you say, the Trump administration is coordinating with the state party in every state?
You know, they don't always win. They tried to abolish the New Hampshire First in the Nation primary. That didn't go down too well in New Hampshire because they understand its importance to New Hampshire's influence in the country at large. So that fell on deaf ears. And I like to say that the people of New Hampshire were the first ones to stand up to Donald Trump this year. And I hope they'll do it again on February 11th.
I'd like to take another call here. 1-800-423-8255. We've got John from Quincy. John, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I'm curious how you feel about the regime change wars that we're constantly doing. And, you know, seeing how you feel about being in every single conflict with every single country and just our military budget just expanding continually and our debt also expanding.
Let's turn that over to the governor.
Well, I've said many times I'm not in favor of boots on the ground for regime change every time we see something in another country that we don't like. And that's a temptation if you get to feeling, you know, too free with your power when you live in the White House. But it's not good for the country at large. And I am ever mindful of the fact that those body bags that come back from those conflicts, they contain people who are 20 to 23 years old. So I think we want to think long and hard before we send boots on the ground for regime change. And I've said that many times. I don't understand why we have troops in Afghanistan. I do think that the out-of-control trillion-dollar deficits have to be eliminated and eliminated quickly, as I did in Massachusetts with a similar situation. And you can't spare any account there. So I think there's money to be saved everywhere, including the military. Including, you know, bureaucracies in Washington that nobody really knows what they do, but they were the pet child of some long-dead U.S. senator. Got to get rid of those entirely.
Let's bring in another call. We've got Amanda on the line from Cambridge. Amanda, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I'm a registered independent, obviously in Massachusetts. I do tend to vote Democratic, mostly based on social issues. I did vote for Governor Weld, and I thought that he did a great job in the state. And while I do have a number of Democratic candidates in mind for president, if he won the Republican candidacy and ultimately became president, I would be very comfortable with that.
All right. There you go, Governor Weld.
Thank you, Amanda. Spoken like a true Cantabrigian.
So, Governor Weld, Amanda's comments raise a couple of questions for me. The first is, you have run as a libertarian in the past. Why run as a Republican here, especially given what you just told me about the sort of the Republican infrastructure and power structure? Why not run as an independent? Does running as Republican just weaken President Trump and make him a weaker opponent against Democrats? Or did you think that this was the path that would get you the nomination versus running as an independent?
Well, I wanted the direct shot at Mr. Trump because I think he's a clear and present danger to our democratic institution. So I didn't want to dribble around the court. I wanted to go right for the hoop. And, you know, when you run as a third party, people say, oh, who did your votes come from? When I run directly against Mr. Trump, there's no question about where my votes come from. They come from Mr. Trump, and that's just how I wanted it.
So given that straight shot at the basket, if you don't get the nomination, will you then work to support a Democratic challenger to Donald Trump? Are you that concerned about him being reelected?
Well, I would never support Mr. Trump. I think he's dangerous to the country. So I would support someone else. Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Let's take another call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Chris from Leominster, go ahead.
Hi, Governor Weld. I just want to lead off saying I am an independent voter in Massachusetts. I am planning on voting for you in the primary. I just have
a quick question, though.
If you are elected, what are you going to do to help the middle class in an economy that, frankly, has not been great to the middle class under Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, I'm going to make sure that all the people who get displaced because of all the artificial intelligence and drones and robotics and driverless cars and machine learning and all that, which is going to be like 15% to 20% of all jobs, get the post-secondary, three semesters of post-secondary training and technical skills that will get them replacement jobs at higher wages. Those are Trump voters, should be Trump voters, displaced workers. No one is rolling up their sleeves in Washington and seeing that that happens. But those are already middle-class voters. You know, long-haul trucker, maybe at the high end of that. Those are great jobs. They pay $140,000 a year. But the first day that the trucks, the driverless trucks hit the interstates, those people are going to be out of a job. And they are capable people. They know everything that's going on under the hood of that car. And it's not just a simple engine anymore. It's a computer. So they're going to have a relatively easy retraining path. But I've run the numbers. And even at the state level, it's 1/3 of 1% of a state budget. And to govern is to choose. And when you have something that's a state emergency or a national emergency, you go right to it. And you solve the problem, and that's what I would do. So that would be going right to the middle class. I also would want to support the working poor and people a couple of rungs below the middle class, and because I'm worried about the social fabric, social cohesion in this country because of the divisiveness of the Trump administration.
Governor Weld, I want to shift gears because we have a limited amount of time left. I want to talk about impeachment for a minute. The Senate trial begins on Tuesday. You began your career as junior counsel on the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee during the 1974 impeachment inquiry against President Nixon. With that in mind, do you think the House handled its role properly in waiting to provide the articles to the Senate?
Well, yes, I do. And I had to read the transcript of every impeachment trial in history. I was a Republican member of the staff for the House Judiciary Committee on the Nixon impeachment, and I got very familiar with the reasons for the impeachment and removal clause. And the two things that the people, the founders, the framers, were most concerned about were foreign interference in our affairs and corruption of office, by which they meant the president using his office to benefit himself, whether financially, politically, whatever, as opposed to trying to benefit the country exclusively. Both of those top fears of the people who wrote the removal clause are here in spades in the Ukraine article, Article 1, and I think Article 2 is also, there's a similar article in the Nixon impeachment. But I think the case for impeachment on the facts adduced by the House is, frankly, overwhelming. If this is not impeachable, nothing ever would be.
Sorry to interrupt. I want to get a couple more things in. Do you think there are any Republicans who will peel away and vote in the Senate to find him guilty?
Yeah, I think even now there are a handful who will. But I also think if we get live witnesses in the Senate, I've been a litigator and a prosecutor long enough to know that cases often turn out, they take twists and turns, and virtually nothing is more than 75% predictable in litigation. So you could see a lot more support for removal if new witnesses and new evidence turn up in the Senate.
That's Bill Weld, Republican presidential candidate and former governor of Massachusetts. Thanks so much, Governor Weld, for joining us.
Thank you.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR 90.9, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.